Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Welcome to Talmud. Tonight's topic is women and tefillin. By the way, I won't name you. Feel free to interrupt, stop, ask questions, whatever you want. It's an open forum.
Okay.
So we have kind of a sub-theme this year about women and Jewish law. And tonight's topic is Can women wear tefillin, basically? What's the history of it? So I want to start out with my usual acknowledgement, a shout-out to my former teacher, Rabbi David Galinkin, who is mostly the source of this. He has a book called The Status of Women in Jewish Law, which is enormously useful. So let's review where we are with women's things prior to starting. And that is, so we have learned that women are exempt from positive time-bound commandments.
Usually.
Except not really.
Yeah.
Frequently.
That's the general rule. There's exceptions in both directions. Mm-hmm. Torah rules, rabbinic rules. Okay. So there's really kind of three possibilities given that. One is that women are forbidden from doing things that they are exempt from, which is a minor view, and we will not discuss it. The other two, where women can do the mitzvot with a blessing, and some say without a blessing. And the people who say without a blessing are generally Sephardim, and the people who say with a blessing are general Ashkenazi. But again, that's not hard and fast either, as is nothing in Talmud. So, given that this is a law issue, the best way to approach this, I think, is chronologically, because right, the Talmud is a discussion of the law, but it's rarely a gives you the law. So you have to look to the later people to do that. So I've divided in red chronological periods. So first let's start with tefillin. Anybody know how many times tefillin are mentioned in the Torah? Yeah, so this will surprise you. The answer is four. There are four times it's in the Torah. And two of them are in Deuteronomy, the Shema, and the other part. And two of them, interestingly, are in Exodus. And that's where the first quote comes from the book of Exodus. Is it?
Yes, because that was Sam's...
Very good.
It was hard to know.
So, I'm impressed that you would know that.
It says, V'haya lecha le'ot al yadecha, and it will be to you for an oat, a sign on your hand, ulzikaron bein einecha, and for a zikaron, which zachor, right, means to remember. Zikaron is translated here as a memorial. It's curious language. Okay, for memorial between your eyes, and why? So that you will remember the Torah of God in your mouth. Why? Because with a strong hand, God has brought you out of Egypt. So this is a little mysterious about what exactly are tefillin doing in this verse. I have nothing to say about that at all, but there are a lot of things in this parsha about evoking the exodus from Egypt, eating matzah, not eating chametz, redeeming the firstborn of men and animals. So feel free to fill in your own theory here about why we would have tefillin.
Question.
Yes.
Why we should have tefillin. What's the logic that it didn't be that line was translated as a tattoo on your hand?
So that is a good question. Okay, so I was just going to point out that out of the four times tefillin is mentioned here, it is called a zikaron, but the other three times it is called Totafot. What are Totafot? Nobody knows. And the thinking here was possibly it's some kind of an amulet, and that's why you wear it. Mm-hmm. But really, nobody knows. That's where the oral law comes in. Okay, so that's the background. Now we go to the Talmud. And this is in the Tractate of Eruvin. And it has a key because this is the key source for everything we'll talk about tonight, this very first part. For it was taught. Now that means a baraita, right? So that's one of the three ways there are things get into the Talmud. A baraita is the category of things my mother once told me, like, don't go in the pool for half an hour until you, after you've eaten. It's just something we get handed down that's a fact. So it was taught, Michal, the daughter of the Cushite, now Michal, that is the daughter of Shaul, King Saul, who married King David, wore tefillin, and the sages did not attempt to prevent her. That's the very big key line, and we'll see this over and over. And the wife of Jonah attended the festival pilgrimage, and the sages did not prevent her. So Jonah and the whale, Jonah and the great fish, they're saying that, right, all Jews have an obligation to go to Jerusalem for the three holidays every year, except it's only incumbent upon men. Yet Jonah's wife, who doesn't even have a name other than Jonah's wife, apparently went, and that was okay. So this is really the fundamental source for women can wear tefillin. But we'll see how it evolves over time. Now, there's a long paragraph here, which I'll read through quickly, because it's not really relevant, but it is interesting. Now, since the sages did not prevent her, it is clearly evident they hold the view that it is a positive precept, the performance of which is not limited to a particular time. So, what are they saying here? They're saying that wearing tefillin is not a PTBC. It's not a positive time-bound commandment. That's how the Gemara is justifying that Michal could wear tefillin. But now it goes on to dispute that. But is it not possible that he holds the same view as Rabbi Yossi, who said it is optional for women to lay their hands upon an offering? We talked about that the very first time, about, again, this is an optional item, and the women apparently did it. For were you not to say so, so now they're going back to the logic. How is it Jonah's wife attended the festival pilgrimage and the sages did not prevent her? By the way, the normal translation of this is that the sages did not protest. Seeing that there is no one who contends with the observer. So what are they saying here? That, okay, we're trying to make the case that tefillin are not time-bound commandments. But now they're lumping Michal with Jonah's wife, who's going to the pilgrimage, and that is definitely a time-bound thing. So there's no similarity between those two things, so you can't make that argument about it being optional. Okay, so now they go on to really make another proof, if you will. Now, what they are talking about here is a case where it's Shabbat and you find tefillin on the street. Now, you're not allowed to carry. That is a major no-no worthy of death. So what do you do with the tefillin? So the rabbis say that this view about Michal is from another source. It's from a Tana, a teacher, who taught another Baraita. If tefillin are found, they are to be brought in. So if you find tefillin, you can't leave them in the street. That's the first thing. How do you bring them in? One pair at a time, which means you wear them. You put the tefillin on, you wear them into your house, you take them off. Irrespective of whether the person who brings them in is a man or a woman. Wow. So it's incumbent equally upon men and women. Returning lost objects is a Torah mitzvah. It's a very important one. So that has very high status. So regardless of man or woman, and regardless of whether the tefillin were new or old, so say Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Judah forbids this in the case of new ones, but permits it in that of the old ones. What's going on here? So, here's what the logic is. Old tefillin are definitely tefillin, but new tefillin might be mistaken for an amulet, which would be like a piece of jewelry, and therefore you couldn't wear it. That's the argument they're making here.
I thought jewelry was allowed to be worn.
Well, yeah, yes and no. You're right, but it's not clear about that. Okay. So this is the case here. So again, you have Rabbi Meir saying women must wear tefillin to find in, therefore meaning it's legal for them to do that, and Rabbi Judah says basically the same thing.
But tefillin were always a black box. How would you confuse that for jewelry or an amulet.
You know what? So jewelry is probably a bad word to use here, but amulet is definitely, it's something you're not allowed to wear on Shabbat.
Right.
Put it that way.
What about the time? I mean, I don't really know, but I mean, we always wear tefillin only in the morning. So isn't that time? Isn't there something with time with tefillin?
Yes. So in ancient days, the goal was to wear tefillin all day long, 24 hours. But then the rabbis, and we'll see this later, didn't want you to sleep in them because they were worried you would have some kind of bodily fluid issue in the night, and that would disgrace the tefillin. So they declared only during the day. So that made it time bound, as well as the fact that you do not wear tefillin on Shabbat
right.
and on Yom Tov. And the reason for that, by the way, is because Shabbat is the word ot. Shabbat is also an ot, which is a sign. So tefillin is a sign, Shabbat is a sign. If Shabbat is already a sign for you, you don't need to put tefillin on Shabbat. And I will say, Sephardim actually take off their tefillin in the night in these days, and they hang it on the wall so they can see it. Okay, last part of this piece here. Now, since the dispute is only to the question of new and old, but in respect of the woman, there is no divergence of opinion. Very important. It may be concluded that it is a positive precept, the performance of which is not restricted to a particular time, women being subject to the obligations of such precepts. So the Gemara's conclusion here is that wearing tefillin is not a positive time-bound commandment, and therefore women can wear tefillin. Okay. So this was not the common view of the Tanaim. The Tanaim did believe that tefillin is a positive time-bound commandment. But here is certainly a valid alternative view. Okay, we move along. Now we're in the tractate Brachot, Blessings, and there's a Mishnah, the famous Mishnah. Women, slaves, and minors are exempt from reciting the Shema and from putting on tefillin, but they are subject to tefillah, mezuzah, and birkat hamazon. All right. Why are they exempt from reciting the Shema and tefillin? It doesn't say. Turn the page.
Well, maybe because I thought it was time-bound.
But there's a big time that you can say the Shema in the morning and evening, so
it's true, but...
Okay, so let's see. The Gemara says that they are exempt from the Shema is self-evident. It is a positive precept for which there is a fixed time. So they're coming in and making this argument, right, that the Shema is time-bound because you have to say it in morning and evening. But if that's true, why did they even bother to put that in the Mishnah? Why would they have even said that? So perhaps women are, this is one of these exception things, perhaps women are obligated to say the Shema, even though it is time-bound positive commandment. So therefore, the Mishnah is coming to teach us that nevertheless, women are exempt. So the Gemara now dodges and weaves. What?
To feel is the Amidah, right?
Tefillah is the Amidah. Shema is its own mitzvah. So now they go to another possibility. You might say that because it mentions the kingship of heaven, it is different. So the second paragraph of the Shema talks about accepting Ol Malchut Shemaim, the yoke of heaven, which means you accept the mitzvot on you. And they're saying maybe because the Shema says this, this is an exception and therefore women say it. Therefore, it's linked to tefillin. We are therefore told this is not so. So that explanation is rejected. So women are exempt from Torah study, and because we talked about this in the first time, because they're exempt from Torah study, which is reading the Shema, they are therefore exempt from tefillin. That's the argument that's being made. Now, here's the point about this. Right? The Mishnah really does not offer an explanation of why women are exempt from the Shema and Tefillin. So what's going to happen now is the rabbis are going to try to fill in the blanks, which we'll get back to that. Well, we'll see it right away, actually. Okay, so now we move along to the Mechilta de Rebbe Yishmael. This is a collection of halachic midrash, to the book of Exodus. Why the book of Exodus? Because that's the first time tefillin are mentioned. And also, there's another source which goes along with it. It's a parallel source called the Pesikta Rabbati, which is, again, another collection of Midrash, and this dates from around 800s CE. And it is the source of the next text, which is in the Yerushalmi, but we'll read this one first. So it starts off with the proof text all the way from the beginning, from the first page, which is Lema'an tehiye Torat Hashem b'picha, in order that the words of the Torah will be in your mouth. What is the intent of this? Is the question that's asked. From, and it shall be to you as a sign. Now he asks a pretty common sense question. I would assume that women, too, are included in the mitzvah of tefillin. And this would follow, since both mezuzah and tefillin are positive commandments, then if we have learned that mitzvah of mezuzah obtains with women as well with men, the same is true of the mitzvah of tefillin. Does everyone get the argument he's making? Mm-hmm. It's really the reverse of what we just read. Mm-hmm. Since they mentioned mezuzah and it's a time-bound thing, then tefillin is a time-bound thing, it's okay too. It is therefore written with respect to tefillin, so the mitzvah of tefillin may be in your mouth. The mitzvah of tefillin obtains only with one who is commanded to study Torah. From here they derived. All are commanded to put on tefillin except women and slaves. So this is back again explaining why women are exempt. But they give you the standard exceptions again. Michal, the daughter of Cush, would wear tefillin. Jonah's wife would go to Jerusalem for the festival. And Tavi, Rabbi Gamliel's bondsman, would wear tefillin. Bondsman is slave. I don't know why I didn't change that. So I put this in for fun because Tavi is kind of a beloved figure in the Talmud. He's the slave of Rabbi Gamliel, but Rabbi Gamliel allowed him to put tefillin on, even though you just saw slaves are exempt from tefillin. And there's all these stories about Tavi, and Tavi dies and he mourns 7 days for him, even though he's not a relative, and he's a slave, and as a slave he's not a full Jew. So there's all these fun Tavi stories, but this carries a lot of weight once again. Okay, now we're basically going to get the same text, and now this is in the Yerushalmi about the exemption, and here we get kind of the first interesting twist. So it's really coming from the same place. It asks the same question. How do we know women are exempt from tefillin? It's a different proof text. Here it says, you shall teach it to your sons, right? We say that in the Shema twice a day, to Bneichem, which could be read as your children, and we talked about this before, but it could also be read as your sons. So it's read as your sons, which means not your daughters. Therefore, this is the mitzvah of teaching Torah, and the Torah is telling you, you have no obligation to teach Torah to your daughters. So one who is obligated to learn Torah is obligated to wear tefillin. Women who are not obligated to learn Torah are not obligated to wear tefillin. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And now they come once again with Michal. Michal wore tefillin, the wife of Yonah went on the pilgrimage, and the sages didn't protest. And now comes the 180-degree twist. Rabbi Hizkia said, quoting Rabbi Abahu, another baraita, Yonah's wife returned, meaning she did come back for the pilgrimage, and as for Michal, the sages did protest. So see, now each camp has, how do you say that, a dog in the race, a dog in the fight. So you have one piece of Talmud text that says the sages did not protest. You have the Yerushalmi, which says the sages did protest. You can hang your hat on either one.
Now, does it say any place else besides here that they protested?
No. These are the places where it says it. But here's an interesting thing. When you go to do halakha, and you have a dispute between the Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud always wins. That's one of the rules.
Right.
So that gives you license to reject this Yerushalmi.
Yeah, but also it says that they're not obligated, but that doesn't forbid them.
Correct. Well, yes, they're not obligated, but here it is, they are saying it's forbidden. Okay, because Sages protest.
Yeah, the Sages protested.
Can we go back to the previous paragraph,
sure,
which is about all are commanded to put on tefillin except women and slaves, and why that was so? And I had learned in the past that why were they specifically not allowed to? Well, that they weren't obligated. Well, because women were very busy with the family, taking care of the children and nursing. It was a 24/7 job.
Right.
And then the slaves were busy. Their highest obligation was doing the work of the master. So that took precedence over the Torah study. So that's why they're exempt. But the whole thing that, maybe I'm getting ahead of us here, but my whole concern is that it's different from being obligated to. If you're not obligated to, it doesn't mean you can't.
Correct.
Because it could still be seen as optional, right?
Yes. So we spent the whole evening on this. The idea that what you're saying is that women and slaves share the characteristic that their time is not their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very popular explanation, but there's no basis for it.
Hmm.
And we talked about a number of possible reasons, and the final answer was, there is no final answer, but the final answer was, we don't know.
Or because,
which is why there's so many exceptions.
Okay, or because at the time of the Torah, women and slaves were seen as property, and as property, they're not.
I'm going to fight you on that.
I don't think women were property.
Right.
That's why they're acquired under the chuppah.
And
that's. And then they have the ketubah, which gives us rights.
Well, some rights, and that was very far thinking for the time, but compared to now, it's not.
No, I would fight you on both of those statements. By the way.
That's okay, don't feel bad. This
no,
is
I as a woman, I have a problem with it, obviously. Yeah,
women back then had a lot of children, too, so they were basically,
right,
you know, present a lot.
Right.
I mean, not like today, where they have, like, you know, two children. And so.
So I'll give you the 50-cent response to this,
okay,
is that, yes, it's true, women and men were not equal in those days,
mm-hmm,
but at the same time, the rabbis were working very hard within the limits of their system to promote equality. Women were not chattel. Slaves were not chattel. If you injured your slave, you had to set him free,
mm-hmm,
right? If he was your chattel, that wouldn't be true. And as for women getting acquired in marriage, it's a legal thing of an act of possession, but it's not acquired in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I own you.
Mm-hmm.
Women came into the marriage with rights. They retained rights throughout the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Like if a woman brought property into the marriage, she had to retain that property when she left. Now, again, that wouldn't be true if she was chattel.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought of the obligation of not allowed or allowed, not so much as chattel or ownership or being too busy, but rather the menstruation cycle,
mm-hmm,
where women, when they're menstruating, are impure,
mm-hmm,
so therefore they wouldn't be allowed to fulfill the menstruation.
Okay, and we will talk about that directly.
Yeah, but I was going to say, but that is, a lot of people think that's why women are not supposed to touch the Torah, but what I learned is that the holiness of the Kedusha of the Sefer Torah is so great that someone who is tumah or impure doesn't affect it.
You are correct. There is, that's a myth. Women can touch Torah,
mm-hmm, yeah,
but then why,
in whatever state.
Then why is it such a, why would they never call a non-Jew up to the Torah? I mean, the Torah is so sacred that nothing could affect it, then why not give a...
The answer is going to be it's another obligation thing. I would say non-Jew doesn't have an obligation to read Torah,
yeah,
but a Jew does.
That. I mean, they get very, like, I remember one of my daughters was bat mitzvah, and a good friend of ours, she's Jewish, but she married someone who wasn't, so her last name was, like, Irish, and I can't,
mm-hmm,
you know, like, she's Jewish, like, you know, before they were.
They're afraid that the pagans will lie to you in front of the Torah.
You mean they don't?
But they're much more concerned than it.
Yeah, you know. I would have thought it was more a question of you only have so many people that you can give an honor to for the Torah. So if you give an honor to somebody for whom it's meaningless, then you're sort of in a sense, wasting one of the potential honors.
Because pagans were allowed to offer sacrifices in the temple.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
I didn't know that either.
That is true.
Which is one of the reasons why the temple was destroyed.
Because of the pagans? They had bad sacrifices?
There's a whole story about that later.
Okay, you'll see. We'll just go on.
Okay,
all right, so this is all the Talmudic materials. And now we move into the period of the Rishonim, which is roughly 1,000 to 1,500 CE. And here's where we're going to see where things change. let me stop before there. So at this point in time, there were really three camps of opinion here. The first, I'll call them three groups. So group one, which is the Ravid, which is exemplified by the Ra'avad, these are all famous rabbis, some I'll give you more on, which is women are exempt, but it is possible that because they are exempt, they will not treat the mitzvot seriously. It will be frivolous. So that's why the sages would protest, because women would not observe them properly. Now, this is a very small group of people who have this philosophy. Group two, it consists of Rashi among many other famous people who I've written down, Ramban, Rif, Rosh, Tur, Shulchan Aruch, all say women may perform positive time-bound commandments without a blessing. A group three, which is the largest group, say women may perform positive time-bound commandments with a blessing. And their main support is this text we read in Eruvin, where it says the sages do not protest. So there's even a statement, and they can occupy themselves with that mitzvah like Michal Bat Kushi, who it can be assumed recited a blessing. There's your proof. All right, so those are the three groups of opinions. Now we're going to go to the Rishonim, and we're going to see where things changed. So first of all, we have the Tosafot, who are Rashi's grandchildren, and they are commenting on the verse in Eruvin we just read. It would seem that according to those who rule that women are not allowed to wear tefillin, the rationale is that wearing tefillin requires guf naki, which means a clean body. And women are not sufficiently careful in this respect.
What?
Okay, so football season. Football season now, there's an end run, right? So they're not using the positive time-bound commandment rule here. They've come up with a brand new rationale, which is clean body.
Well, back in the day, didn't men go to the mikveh every single day?
No, not necessarily. But by the time the Rishonim, they didn't go at all.
Okay.
In temple times, they went.
Because if men were going every single day to the mikveh, you have to be clean in order to go into a mikveh. So then if you davened afterwards, then...
So the rule was a man could not daven if he had ejaculated, he had to go to the mikveh first.
Right, so in order to prevent privacy,
it was embarrassing to see
everybody have to go every day.
If you come into class and your teacher says, oops, boys, I got to go take a bath, I'll be back in 10 minutes, it would be embarrassing, so the law was suspended for men.
Oh, I thought that they had to go every day, so that way you wouldn't know who did what when.
No, they just stopped going.
Ah, okay.
So now they're going to throw up this other thing about gufna ki, and we'll see what people think that means. But that's where we start from. So now comes the smoking gun. That's my favorite little thing.
Wait, I have a quick question. Do you think that he means with the gufna ki that because of women menstruating or something?
So hold on to that question, because we're going to see what people think that means. So now we have the cold bow. This is just, it's always fun, it's like a maze. The cold bow was Rabbi Aharon HaKohen of Lunel. He was a Provençal rabbi who lived in Narbonne, France, who suffered the expulsion of the Jews from France in 1306, where he went to Majorca to live out his days. There he wrote a book, among others, called The Cold Bow. In The Cold Bow, he quotes the Maharam. The Maharam is Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who died in Germany in 1296. And he, the Maharam, is the source of this text. So what does he say? Maharam writes that women are exempt from tefillin because it is a positive time-bound commandment, since we don't wear it on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Fine, that's nothing new here. And if they want to wear it, we do not allow them, because they don't know how to keep themselves clean. Nikiyut. So, this is the basis for women not wearing tefillin to this day. This one quote from the Maharam. And now, we're going to start going in depth here. So, first of all, we have a problem. Right? Because Rabbi Aharon HaKohen, the Kol Bo, himself asked in his text, how can the Maharam rule against the plain meaning of the text we had in Eruvin, being Michal wore tefillin and the sages not protest. So he points that out right away, that this is a problem. Now, there were many supporters and many disagreeers. I couldn't think of a better word, opponents, I guess.
Dissenters.
So Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, does not quote the Maharam in the Shulchan Aruch, because he apparently doesn't agree with him. And, you know, it gets complicated. I'll just read this to you. But Yosef Karo wrote a longer work called the Beit Yosef, where he quotes the Mechilta, really the Pesikta, and the sages protested, so he contradicts himself, but it's all pointed out that the Maharam does not quote the Pesikta. At any rate, the Pesikta loses to the Babylonian Talmud, as I said earlier. As I told you, it's a little bit of a maze. The Maharshal, which is Rabbi Shlomo Luria, who is 1500, he quotes the Beit Yosef, that's the companion of the Shulchan Aruch, and says the sages didn't protest Michal, true, but why? She was an extremely righteous woman. So she was a special person who could get away with this. She was a king's wife. And here, Hadassah, you will like the fact that she had no children. So the thought was she could keep herself clean, unlike ordinary women, because she didn't have to chase after little ones. Okay, where does he get this from? This whole thing about Michal? He makes it up. He reads it into the text. Second problem with the Maharam. Where does he get the idea that women don't know how to keep clean? So, Rambam rules that anyone who is impure, and now this would, it would pertain to men really, but he doesn't give a sex, you are still obligated to wear tefillin. So back again to the bodily fluids, your tumah, you still have to wear tefillin. That is the halakha. And finally, and this is what Hadassah, you were saying about the Torah and women menstruating. In Brachot, there's a statement, words of Torah are not susceptible to impurity, to tumah. You can't make a Torah impure. That's the way it goes. So that doesn't make any sense. So it's very hard to understand what the Maharam says here. Now we go on to some other things. So they pick up the bit with this, and now the issue is going to be, what does it mean to have a clean body? And they're going to come now and try and come up with definitions to see, I don't want to say to see if they can exclude women, but to further define whether this applies or not. So in the Bavli, Rabbi Yonah said, donning tefillin requires a clean body. What does it mean? Abaye said, you can't break wind while donning. No farting with tefillin.
That would disqualify him of our Sunday crew.
That's a tough one, by the way, because I know the halakha. I know the halakha on this, and it's you're not allowed to fart while wearing tefillin. Let's put it that way. Rava said, it's a companion of Abaye, you're the opponent of it, it means not to sleep in them. So first of all, the sages themselves don't agree on what it means to have a clean body. There's also thought that this might mean spiritually clean, as in not having evil thoughts. And indeed, the halakha is for men, if you are focusing on a woman, don't put on tefillin, because you're not spiritually clean in order to do that. That is a real halakha. And I don't know, I wanted to point out somewhere, there's also lots of controversies about, it says guf naki, but it doesn't say tuma, which is impurity. Mm-hmm. So there are people who want to argue that not clean body is conflated with being impure, which requires going to the mikvah and all of that. But again, impure does not apply when it comes to tefillin. You put on tefillin when you're impure. Okay. Now we have a teshuva of the Maharam, which is backing this up. Is a person who has had nocturnal pollution, a nocturnal emission, permitted to put on tefillin? The custom is widely accepted to permit such a person to study Torah, to recite prayers, and to put on tefillin. So the Maharam himself, this is kind of another dig, he says impurity has nothing to do with it. So we go there. Okay, so that's second approach. Now let's try a third approach. So we have a verse in Deuteronomy. A man must not wear women's a woman must not wear men's clothing, and a man must not wear women's clothing, for the Lord your God detests anyone who does this. So what are they doing here? They are defining tefillin as men's clothing.
Well, yeah.
It's good you said that, because let's continue reading. Well, actually, you jumped.
You're supposed to wait 5 minutes before you say that.
Well, so now we have... Now we have the Rima. So he's going to apply in two cases. So the Rima is Rabbi Moshe Isserles. He wrote the Ashkenazic Guide to the Shulchan Aruch, which was Sephardi. So we follow him. And the Rima in the Shulchan Aruch says two things that contradict themselves. And it's always interesting, he's brought up as a source, but he internally makes no sense. So he says on one hand, the anti-side, the Maharam wrote that women are exempt from tefillin because they are positive time-bound mitzvot, and they are not worn on Shabbat and Yom Tov. And if they want to wear tefillin, one does not listen to them because they do not know how to maintain cleanliness. So that's the halakha in the Shulchan Aruch that applies to Ashkenazim. However, the same guy, a couple paragraphs down, where he's talking about tzitzit, and look what he says. Women and slaves are exempt from tzitzit, right? We saw that in the Mishnah, because it is time-dependent commandment. The Rima glosses on that. And if they wish to wrap themselves in tzitzit and say the blessing, it is up to them to do so as with all time-dependent commandments. So he is contradicting himself. He's saying women can wear tzitzit with a blessing.
No, how is tzitzit time-bound? You're supposed to have it on the corner of your garments.
Because again, you take them off at night. So therefore it becomes time-dependent.
Not if you're up all night with a baby.
So that's interesting of itself. Oh, I'm sorry, my notes are out of order here. So I want to go back to the text from Deuteronomy about men and women's clothing. So there was another rabbi in 1650, Rabbi Hillel ben Naftali Hertz. Now, you're probably aware that the entire Torah was translated in the time of the Talmud into Aramaic. and not just once, but by several people. So there's Targum Onkelos. Onkelos was allegedly a Roman convert. There's also Pseudo-Yonatan. I don't know who he was, but he's another guy. And in his Aramaic translation of men's clothing in that verse, "A woman must not wear men's clothing," he translates that as a cloak of tzitzit and tefillin.
Pretty specific.
But this same rabbi, he's called Beit Yosef. Everyone has got a nickname. But he is troubled by this because he writes, "We have not found any Tana who thinks we should lash a woman that wears tefillin." In other words, if the translation is true and women did this, they would be subject to a Torah punishment. That punishment would be whiplashes. And he's saying that never really happened. Therefore, nobody really believes that men's clothing means tefillin and tzitzit. And other people point out, other sages point out that if that were true, why didn't the sages use that as their argument? About the sages would have protested. They would have said, "Michal, you're wearing men's clothing, you can't do that." They don't say that. So that's the argument. The whole clothing issue is a pretty minor one. Okay, finally we have two more texts. The Rashba, who says, "I agree with those who say that if they desire, they can do all such mitzvot, they are women, and recite the blessings on the basis of Michal, who wore tefillin, and they did not protest. Indeed, she did so in accordance with the will of the sages, and by the nature of the matter, she puts on tefillin and she makes a blessing." So the Rashba is pretty high-level rabbi, medieval period. So that's a pretty strong approval. And finally, we have the Mishneh Torah, which is Maimonides and the laws of tzitzit. And he says, "Women, slaves, and children are exempt from tzitzit, both d'oraita from the Torah and d'rabbanan from the rabbis. But women and slaves who wish to wear them may wear them without a blessing, and so too for other mitzvot where women are exempt. If they wish to do them without a blessing, we do not protest." So Rambam himself is saying women can put these, can wear tefillin, but not say the bracha.
But if they start to say the bracha, we protest.
Presumably, yeah, I guess we stop then.
Well, I didn't think if they do the bracha, we're not supposed to listen. That was said earlier.
Listen to them say it?
Yeah. No, the listening was if they say they want to wear.
Oh, we ignore their
request.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's in the Rima, the first
one. Was that because without a blessing, it's not official? I mean, that can...
Right. Well, no, I'll put it a different way, right? So, I've been telling you that mitzvot are obligations. And when you fulfill an obligation, you say a blessing. God commanded me to do this. If God did not command you to do this, it's problematic then if you say the blessing. So there's ways around that too. We talked about that. Like God's commanding the entire Jewish people, not just men, or not just slaves, or whatever it is. Now at this point, you might ask the question, did Jewish women historically wear tefillin? The answer turns out to be yes.
If they didn't, they wouldn't have been discussing it.
Yeah, probably. Well, there are things in the Talmud they discuss.
But never.
Like, does a man with two heads put on two sets of tefillin? So.
It was like the exception to the rule. What I always heard about was that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin.
Okay, so I have a list of famous women who wore tefillin.
Maybe you're on it.
So Michal is obviously the first one. Bruria, who was the wife of Rabbi Meir, who was really the only female scholar of Torah in the Talmud.
She was a judge, too, no? Wasn't she a judge?
I don't think she was a judge. I don't think she would have been allowed to.
Oh, Deborah was.
Yeah.
Deborah was a judge.
Yeah.
There is a legend that Rashi's daughters all wear tefillin, but there's no proof for it.
Mm-hmm. No pictures.
But the thing is, if all of these are carried down, you know, so much of the Talmud was carried down orally for many, many years before it was written down, why is it that everyone else seems to know about this legend of Rashi's daughters. My feeling is that it must have been true.
Well, but what about Washington chopping down the cherry tree?
Oh, man, we've Everybody been married too long. I was just going to say
but
that.
He did that.
This cool. always spooks me when she does that. Yeah. It's a legend, right? We all believe, we all believe in certain things. We inherit certain things from our families, our communities.
I'm changing my name to Mr. Minhag.
MM, we'll call you.
No, wait, we already did.
So, yes, Rashi's daughters was one. Now, there's all kinds of interesting, you know, books are written, not just legal books. So there are letters we have from 13th century France that talk about women wearing tefillin. And also from 16th century Italy. And really interesting, there was a woman called the Maiden of Ludmere. So this was a 19th century woman who was a daughter of a rabbi and very pious. And she got sick and she had a vision of God and the heavenly court, and she was given a new soul. And when she recovered from her illness, she became a scholar and she put on tefillin and she wore tallis. And she prayed all day and studied Torah, and she used to lecture men. She was that learned from behind a curtain. So she wore tefillin. It's a famous thing.
Maybe if you can't see that she's wearing tefillin, it's okay to wear them.
Now, finally, we move into the Achronim, the later period. I stuck the Magen Avraham in here because he's from 1700 Poland, just to show you that even though the Maharam's view was really adopted by everyone, there were still people that did not. So the Magen Avraham says, "We protest." That's the words he's starting with, the proof text. Since they need a clean body, and women are not particularly careful with cleanliness. But if they were obligated, they would not be exempt on that basis. Since they would accept the mitzvah upon themselves, they would be conscientious. So appears to me to be the rule, and he's disputing another sage. You know, this is kind of the common sense argument. Well, if they were putting on tefillin, they would have to be clean, so they'd take care of that. Okay, so that's a pro opinion, but now we come to the very modern period. We have Igrot Moshe. This is Moshe Feinstein, who was the greatest halachic decisor of the last century. And he says, however, it is obvious this applies only if her soul yearns to perform mitzvot, notwithstanding the fact she is not commanded to perform them. So we actually did this when we talked about lighting Hanukkah candles, where there seems to be a later day concern about women who are spiritually yearning, and can we encourage them for the sake of Torah? So that's what he's addressing here, that a woman really wants to do this. However, since it is not with this intent, but rather stems from her protest against God and God's Torah, this is not the act of a mitzvah at all. On the contrary, it is forbidden, since she commits heresy by thinking that it is possible that the laws of the Torah can be changed in this way matter. So what's he talking about? He's talking about women on the wall. In other words, women who form a group to put on tefillin as a protest to the fact that they can't put on tefillin, you can't do that. But he does seem to be saying that if she's really and truly sincere, then it's okay, she can put it on. Probably, he would say, without a blessing. So that's one opinion. Another opinion is Rabbi Henkin, who was another great halachic decisor. And he says, she should not lay tefillin, as the Paschim conclude, the decisors, and this is the thing that the Maharam quotes, Talmud Torah for women was permitted because it was necessary, women's education, in other words, but tefillin are not necessary, and getting back to the spiritual thing, she should strengthen her ties to Judaism in another way. That's what he's saying. Okay. Summary. And you know I never advocate a halachic position, so I'm just going to tell you what I think the plain sense of all these texts are. And this again is Rabbi Golinkin's summary. There is ample halachic justification for women to wear tefillin. The Mishnah exempts them, but the Baraita says that Michal wore tefillin, and The Bavli and the Mechilta said yes, they approved of that. The Yerushalmi did not. Those are kind of the foundations. Almost all the Rishonim approved women doing positive time-bound commandments, either with or without a blessing. A few Rishonim forbid, ignoring everything I've just said. The Maharam ruled on the basis of a clean body. This was adopted by the Rima, which means it became basically Ashkenazic law. But as we've seen, the Rima contradicts himself. Finally, women today are cleaner than they were in the past. And by the way, the idea, someone said this here. Yeah, but that's not a problem. The idea that, to me, this is my own opinion, in terms of personal body cleanliness, I don't see any contest between men and women. I don't care what period of time it is. I mean, let's leave it at that. And historically, there were women who did put on tefillin through the ages. So from here, you can draw your own conclusion or consult your own halakhic authority.
But it became generally forbidden.
Well, it still is forbidden.
And a lot of it was
in the Orthodox.
No, in the Orthodox, but yeah. Conservative changed about 20 years ago, 30 years ago.